I've like 400 tons of games this time.
These guys are counting in tons, friend. Like, they're not even counting games or using tons.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Hi there. My name is George, and welcome to the Crowdfunding Academy podcast. I used to work at Kickstarter, and currently I help creators run successful campaigns with my companies YG and Fantastic Funding. On this podcast, you'll hear from creators and my team how they consistently launch record-breaking campaigns so you can do the same. Welcome, everyone, to the podcast. We have an incredibly exciting guest for you. My name is George, and with us we have
Francisco,
and we have our guest, Jamie Jolly. Did I pronounce it all right?
That's right. You got it, man.
All right. So Jamie has not only raised over $5 on Kickstarter with his games, he has also run a circus. So we have a ton of questions for Jamie around both those things. The game that he has run on Kickstarter is called Oathsworn. Did I say that right?
Into the Deepwood.
Amazing. Oathsworn Into the Deepwood. And we're going to have an amazing discussion today around art, AI-generated art, how he runs his team. And we are definitely going to find out how and why and when he ran a circus. Jamie, do you want to start us off with a small introduction about the game?
Yeah, so Oathsworn is kind of a grand dark fantasy legacy campaign. It was really standing on the shoulders of some of these giant games like Kingdom Death Monster and Gloomhaven and things like that. But it just has been these huge successes in the past in Kickstarter. Really like opened the way, just seeing what the physical max of a game can be. And this is kind of like that attempt, like what happened if you made the craziest, biggest thing you could make and put it in a box and really just go all out for making a world. And so we sort of spent 5 years building this world. And the concept is basically the world has died with the coming of something called the Deepwood, which is this gnarly, chaotic, twisted forest that sort of popped out of nowhere and destroyed civilization. Mankind's left living inside these sort of bastion cities that are like islands in a sea of death and trees. And life kind of sucks in the cities. And if that wasn't bad enough, then the monsters started turning up. And in answer to that threat, the monsters that was trying to scrub all their way into the cities and get to the civilians, you guys are formed, the Oathsworn. You're these bunch of badasses who basically stand in the breach between mankind and what comes out of the woods. And then obviously, you know, the community responded and they up to this point, I think we've raised like 5 million or something on Kickstarter. It's incredible, you know, for what was just an idea in someone's head like 5 years ago, and now it's in the world and people enjoy it. But yeah, that's the general idea of Oathsworn.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that intro. It is pretty amazing. You've done this for 5 years, you said.
About 5 years it took to get this thing in a box. Because the way the game works is you have two sides. You have like an encounter with a big monster. And it has all these lovely, like, kind of Euro high thematic combat-y kind of mechanisms in there, where you've got an AI, a deck that runs the monster and how it reacts to you. And you've got this, like, team of hombres who are kind of going in and trying to use, like, their luck mechanics and some, like, deck card management stuff and called Battle Flow. And you're trying to, like, beat the monster. But before you get to that point, you actually have this story part. So we have this app, a companion app, that reads the story to you. We wrote the 500,000 word story to make that possible, a playable story. I think it's one of the first novels where it's a fully playable novel. And it's as big as the Lord of the Rings series, I believe. I think it's about 500,000 words for Lord of the Rings. So it's as big as that, but playable.
And you don't do anything small, do you?
No, it was a bit nuts. They said it was just like, what happens if you just go to the absolute nth degree? It was like, could it be possible? Could you do it? And that was that. Yeah, that's where it is. So yeah, thankfully we got it in just before COVID hit, because we would never have been able to. Well, we actually had to be saved by our community, because we actually ran into such shipping problems. We literally didn't have enough money to send it. And so after all that 5 years and all that effort and all that amazing funding, we still couldn't physically get that game to people at the price that we'd been able to ask pre-COVID. And so the community gathered around and saved us, and they were incredible. They pitched in a load of extra shipping money to help us get it across the line, and we got there. And so that's like 250 tons of games actually managed to get their way around the world in the middle of like the biggest spike in shipping costs in the history of global product.
Wow. And that is kind of the power of crowdfunding, right? The fact that you actually just build this community and then you can actually go back to them and say, guys, massive problem. We need more money, and they'll actually go and do it.
Yeah, it's definitely strange. You know, you talk to other people in businesses, you're like, So what, they give you the money before they get the product, and then they support you with encouragement and like and kindness and stuff like that. And then they got they show genuine interest in everything you do, and they might even turn up the next thing you do because they like you. But this doesn't make any sense to, you know, it doesn't make sense. This isn't how we do business, you know, like in the world. But it's really wonderful, and it's actually something that's really valuable to protect. I think there's a dangerous ball game gets bigger and bigger that it could become too commercial and too giant. And like at the moment, it's still just at that point where it can be, you know, it's a group of people being people together, you know, like it's, I hope we never lose that.
Amazing. So with that wonderful introduction, Fran, do you want to dive into the art discussion with Jamie?
Yeah. So 5 years ago, was it when you envisioned the game or when you just had the idea that you wanted to make this game and then you started from that point, or you already had a vision, you know what he wanted to build, and it took 5 years to do that?
Yeah, it generally started like Sunday nights. Toby and I, my partner, would gather, and I'd be there with my glass of whiskey, and we just bat things around for hours and hours, just bat our ideas for the world, for the thing. It was really this idea that with this game particularly, not all games, but with this game particularly, we wanted to build a world, and the world had to have a background. It had to have a rich like depth to it. And so we spent like 6 months just churning through all that stuff before we put anything to paper. We had no game mechanisms at that point. We had no artwork of any kind at that point. And so it was just like this pure ideas sort of level. And then obviously it was when we found the Deepwood, I really knew that there was going to be a snowballing of that, because the Deepwood was this like antagonistic concept that just, it kept answering questions for us when it popped. I was like, this is a really interesting concept. You can do all kinds of stuff with it. It allows us to go build a game system around it. And yeah, and that was where things started to pick up. And then not long after that point, we then got on board our artist, who then became, you know, like a big part of our team over the next few years. And, you know, he was there with us as well. Like, you know, we were then iterating on this core concept.
And was it easy to communicate your vision at the beginning, or did you have issues?
Yeah, I mean, we're very fortunate we've been through a bunch of sort of different artists and things over the time that we've had. And we've had, obviously, you have graphic designers as well that are often artists. They are sort of like across the streams a lot. But the conversation, we were very blessed with Donjon, because Donjon at the time, he was just between jobs, and he was heading into Weta Workshop, which obviously is this massive art studio, probably the biggest, most influential one in the world, I would say. They provide a lot of the artwork, concept art, and stuff like they did, like Lord of the Rings, for instance. They did a lot of Hollywood movies, Marvel stuff. You know, like they're lots of big IPs, and they provide a lot of that concept work and stuff, the concept art for those things. So they create, you know, weapons, creatures, you know, environments, all this kind of stuff, and very, very the higher sort of level of art. But he was kind of not quite into that space yet, and he kind of committed to us and be part of what we were doing as well. And that continued on through his time at Weta. Yeah, and so he himself is a trainer of many artists. And so he's a world level kind of artist who has hundreds of thousands of followers in the art community. He has his own like training school. He trains training sessions and things. He trains other artists in how to do rendering and all that sort of thing. So yeah, he's very good at his communication and you can just give him, you know, a spec sheet. And the way it works, to give you an idea of how that comes together, you have an idea in your mind, you have the kind of world set in there. So you've got this idea, okay, right, you've got a besieged city surrounded by the trees, and you've got this kind of like this, you know, got a guard with a torch, like looking over into the mist, you know, with eyes looking back at him from, you know, the shadow of the trees. You've got this kind of concept, you want a piece of art for it. So what we tended to do, which was the easiest thing, is to try and create stuff like a mood board, where we'd be talking about like his ideas of the composition of the picture. Because there's a lot that goes into a shot, like, you know, into an image. You have to obviously have the content of the image, like the characters in them, and then like the character, what stance are they in? What are they wearing? You know, what is there anything particular they need to be said? And with the game, for instance, if you have like a player board that's like this shape, like you have a load of information on this part of the player board, and you need it. You don't need the character there. You need the character out of the way here. And so you have to compose the image, put where everything is going to be, and sort of what zones need to be free of complex detail so that you can actually put your graphics design over the top of it and your information on top of it. And so you kind of do that. You kind of make this spec sheet where you lay out the composition, the characters, the content, and you have like a mood board of like his ideas of things that are kind of cool, exciting, these sort of colors, these sort of these types of armors, maybe weapons and things like that. And you kind of give that as a basic thing, and then he goes away and iterates on it and comes back with these incredible, like just super rendered images. ideas. We would have when we had time back in the beginning, we did do some iteration backwards forwards, different things like the Adendri, who are like plant-based people. We spent a bunch of time going backwards and forwards with them. Like they started off with mouths, and we lost the mouth because we thought it'd be more kind of like feeling that, that alienness and otherness that the Adendri represent. And they have like a lot of like genetic differences from humans. Like they have hair that is vines that itself help create spores, and that spore is how they communicate with each other. They like release the spores into their community. So we wanted to kind of manifest that in the artwork as well. And so there's a lot of like backwards and forwards about these little nuanced bits of the lore that we wanted to see inside the artwork. So we had time to do that a little bit, but actually as you go on, we had like 500 pieces of art or something, you know, Swan.
Oh, wow.
And by the time you get that, you can't just keep iterating backwards and forwards. It takes weeks, you know. It can take, you know, the one thing that, you know, goes away, comes back, goes away, goes back. And you just can't really justify that kind of time because you just need to be moving forward or else you're never going to finish the project. And so as we got, fortunately, we did plan it around that problem. So we started off with like the characters, the different racial groups and things like that within the different peoples. We built those out early because we knew we wanted more time to spend with those. And then when it was coming down to things like weapons and arms and things, it was just quick one shots. Like, here's an idea. Here's a weapon we need. We need a big axe, double bladed. Please make something good. And he'd be like, go away and come back, and it'd be great. As we got further into the deadline, we were getting quicker and quicker at getting stuff done. And fortunately, we had the time originally to kind of get the main design elements of the world sort of built out. But yeah, the sort of idea of spec sheeting is a big thing, like the mood boards and getting, you know, all those kind of bits of detail over it's very good. We found another way that actually helped speed us up, which was pretty good, because my partner Toby, he's a 3D sculptor. And so one thing we had when it was like coming down to that punting of characters and where they needed to be in the boards and stuff like that, we were struggling on that side a little bit in getting that without iteration. So what we actually ended up doing is we ended up designing a bunch of characters in ZBrush, actually in 3D characters, posing them, so like with a big blade in this sort of stance, looking over here. And then we put that into the kind of graphic design area that we need so they could really see where it was going. And then Donjon would be able to take that and paint over the top of it, and then take it, he'd mold it and add to it and make it even way better than we ever did in the kind of small sculpting sort of jobs that we did with it. But certainly it was like, that worked quite well, creating these 3D scenes so that we could just having more people kind of at it, sped things up a bit. But that was another way we did it, is, you know, making these three-dimensional characters and then painting over the top of them to make them, you know, come to life.
Wow, that's amazing. Can I just jump one step back? Because here you are having raised $5 million and then you're saying, oh, we hired this world-class artist, you know, that can work at like the big studios, and they just joined our team. How? Like, how do you find a world-class artist and then attract them to your startup, I guess, at that point, right?
So, yeah. So, well, we're very fortunate. And there's a university I was voted most likely to become a salesman after uni. And so like, there's a little bit of that going on, is that you have to sell these concepts and give people a really good understanding of where things are going. Like, you have to know the market is what, and the industry is what we were doing, really, is that I knew board games. I've been a board game designer for a while at that point, and also knew the market very clearly. And so I was able to, with Toby, like, explain it and show it to Donjon, just how valuable this kind of world can be if you do think that. The irony was is that we ended up losing money on the whole project the first time around. Actually, we're only now making profit on the second Kickstarter, which is fantastic. But at the time, pre-COVID, the numbers were very clear about, actually, if you can make this and make it successful. And so the idea was, is, you know, if we were all prepared to risk this time together. And I think that's another thing, is we were all risking it together, was the thing. Like, we were a team that just, we all had to come, you know, at this knowing that, you know, we all failed equally, we all lost equally in time if nothing came of this thing. And so it was that kind of thing of, like, it wasn't just asking someone else to risk something and us, like, we were all kind of in it together with that. But yeah, just explaining to them, like, how the board game world is exploding as a big concept, and there's still these kind of giant super games that are being created that there's still space for them in the world and that they could be designed. But in terms of, like, the actual finding of Donjon as well, like, I mean, places like DeviantArt and ArtStation are incredible, like, sources. ArtStation is probably like the main way that if you're just somebody looking for an artist, you want to go find a professional, you go to ArtStation. And actually, this is where a lot of the controversy around the AI thing is coming from, is the use of ArtStation in the database. Toby and I had, you know, we've been around, like, games and entertainment and a lot of fantasy stuff and sci-fi and all that. So there's a bunch of artists we knew of, and Donjon was right at the top of Toby's list, actually. I didn't know of him at that point, but Toby did. And he was like, what if we could, you know, just go and be cheeky? Instead of, and we're like, hi, how you doing? You want to give up 2.5 years of your life and come and work for us to make a board game? And you know, it ended up being that we just caught him perfectly at the right time, because he hadn't got the offer to work for a workshop at that point. He was coming out of another job and he just didn't have anything to do at that exact moment in his life. And I was like, that was perfect. And it does seem to be that that's how a lot of things do. If you ever watch like a lot of these, the makings of films type things, like a lot of what happens is these incredible like circumstances where someone just happens to be between things at just the right time. And you bring together this super team of actors and writers and directors. And some of the best films you've ever seen are actually primarily a consequence of this happenstance of a team coming together and actually just being available at the right time. And so that was what with Donjon. He was just happened to be free at that time. And I don't think we'd ever, if it had been a year later, we definitely wouldn't have got him. You know, a year before, we wouldn't have got him. So it just happened to be there at the right time.
So the lesson here is to kind of super boost your serendipity, basically, by just going for it, right? Because you saw this amazing artist. You're both thinking that it would be a bit cheeky to ask him, but you just did. And you just, and then you just happened to catch him at the right time. So I guess the big takeaway here for other folks is, just do it. Just send a message, send an email.
You don't ask, you don't get, right? Like you just, exactly. and you don't, also you don't know like what position people are in, especially I think with the, in the kind of fame world, there's a lot of very famous people not doing an awful lot most of the time, right? Because they do something incredibly big and they do something incredibly well known, but then there's a bunch of other little or smaller things that then people evolve in. Really what they're looking for is satisfaction in their creative outlets. A lot of them are creative people that want to do something interesting and something that excites them. And so the ability to say to Donjon, do you want to make a world? We're going to make something completely, and it's going to be insane. And we're going to have all these kind of creative monsters. And, you know, he loves making monsters, but there's not that much call for making monsters in the concept work that he was doing at the time. Right. And so it was like, for him, I know that was something that was very appealing to him, was the idea of being able to make monsters. Whereas, you know, his day job wasn't letting him do that. It's like, our graphic designer, Utku, is fantastic. He's the Turkish chap over there, but he just wouldn't be happy if he just got to sit down all day painting skulls. He'd be a perfect guy to be Korn's, like, artist, you know. And that was the kind of pitch I did to him, was like, I know you like making skulls. Do you want to make, like, 100 more of them? Because you've got a lot of skulls that need painting in this, you know, a lot of, like, graphic design things need to have this kind of dark, macabre kind of, like, skully type thing going on there. And yeah, I mean, enjoy that.
When we go to your website, you see that the team grew quite a bit. So did that change the way you guys work, or is it still the same?
Yeah, I mean, you're still very much a disparate group of people around the world kind of doing specific jobs when and where we need them. So it's a very large team in numbers, but specifically you're often dipping in and out of that pool of people to get the certain things you need done. We've been very fortunate now is that we've got the point where we can bring on an operations manager, and we were able to get more security around up for our graphic designer as well, and sort of things. So we're starting to build a team that's more able to commit for periods of time. But at the same time, you get a lot of things in the board game world where you just need someone to do something for like 3 or 4 weeks, and then you part ways with them for a bit. So that sort of freelance world is very common in board gaming and sort of gaming in general.
So you guys are about to start to work on your next game?
Yep.
Yeah.
And getting sort of wrapped up. That was just all this sort of closing out the file preparation for the big print run for the last Kickstarter that we've done. We've got over 20,000 games that we're making for the second Kickstarter, and making sure those are all kind of like put to bed and safe, and then getting ready, therefore, back into development for the next set of games we're making.
Did you say 20,000?
That's like 400 tons of games this time. That's a lot.
Those are impressive numbers, because we talk to some clients sometimes and they have issues with the minimum order for the factories, but you guys definitely don't have that issue.
These guys are counting in tons, friend. Like, they're not even counting games or usage. Tons.
To be honest, so with this game, is kind of one-to-one. You know, a ton to a game is basically where it sits. The thing weighs 55 pounds, so it's a big old beast. Wow. But yeah, I suppose there's something within that market like board games, because it's like you can make a Tiddly Widdly game and you can go all the way up this giant, massive, like Oswald type thing, is that within that you've got within it its own little financially viable, like kind of like graph, that kind of things work out. So you can make a small game, but generally those types of games, they're very difficult to make a splash with. If you want to really kind of commit to something and make it your job and be able to get to a point where it's financially viable to make it your job, then it's one of those things where you kind of have to be prepared to risk an awful lot to get that, make that possible. And we're very fortunate, I think very blessed that we've been asked to get there with Osworn. But the other path that the majority of people have is that one, they don't have the money to risk it in the first place, and they don't have the time to risk it, or it's a bit too risky because it's just not, it's not something that people are kind of comfortable with making that kind of risk. And so with a lot of the ways as you make, you start making smaller games. But because the vast majority of companies that are in the board game space make smaller games at that level, you know, sort of those are 1-2 man operations that are making these games, that want to come in with a 15-20 grand budget, their project, and they're prepared to risk that and get it. Because so many are in that, it's a saturated end of the market, which is quite difficult to make a big impression in. And there's an awful lot of iteration very, very quickly within that group of people. Whereas with the giant games, there is very little iteration. And it's much slower because it takes you 200, 300 grand to make a game at that level. And it's a huge investment of time. Some of these games are like giant icebergs that slowly pass each other in time. And so with that, there's a great opportunity to go places no one's ever gone before, because it's just this great open ocean of space where you can make stuff, but incredibly risky, incredibly dangerous. You know, ships sink in that ocean. So you've got to be a bit careful with that. And so the success of the one is kind of connected to that fact that it's just so few super giant games out there at that end of the market.
I'm going to move on to the next topic, which is a bit more controversial. Do you think someone using an AI image generator, would they be able to create something like Osworn, or do you think it's completely impossible?
I've loved seeing the rise of this thing. It's been fascinating because obviously if you spend like a couple of years when you're just doing nothing but looking at pictures and doing art and making stuff for games, you get very interested in the process of this stuff. So I got into the beta of DALL-E 2 when it first came out at the beginning of last year, and we were playing around with it, and me and my friend were sitting there trying to get it to make an Ursus, like the bear. We were trying like bear warrior with armor, runic stuff, you know, carrying an axe, doing this thing, and like, we're trying to get it to make a dragon. And you had that, like, this weird spaghetti monster, and it was all over the place. And there was like legs and arms and things, and just it looked like something from the Warp of 40K. You know, it was a terrifying thing. And it really couldn't do nearly anything that you wanted it to do at that point. But in terms of a creative at my end of the market, it could do cats and dogs and stuff like that to a fairly reasonable degree. But then seeing it then grow from there into like Stable Diffusion, and you get to Mid Journey and stuff like that, and you're seeing all those types of things popping up. And then all of a sudden you're seeing them create stuff that is genuinely like incredible, like actual, like world-class level images. If you were to have an artist make those, they would be at a world-class level. And have that happening like 6 months, 8-9 months, it was doing that in, was insane. Like to see that level, that how quick that was. I mean, if you think back to when we were doing, I mean, you guys, you know, you're probably around the same sort of generation. I mean, you can remember what the graphics revolutions were like in when we were younger in games. I mean, we went from like the Game Boy Advance, you know, and you had to like the Mega Drive and the Nintendo 64 and the Dreamcast. And, you know, you kept going out and out. And it just took like 25 years. It took that long to go from this to this. AI has managed to do that 20-year cycle in the quality of their images in about 6 months, which is scary, right? It's insane. This is the thing that gets with AI, is I don't think people realize we're not hardwired by any of the previous technology that's come before to realize how quickly this is going to iterate. We're not ready for it, because we are not going to be able to catch up with realizing just what it's capable of, because it's going to be so far ahead of that by the time we realize it. You know, there'll already be even more things. And so that's where it's going to start coming in. That I don't think that when people as a group, as a mass, a common sort of knowledge level group of people, just don't realize something quick enough, that's where kind of stuff can start going off the rails a bit and go awry, is we don't realize just how impactful and how disruptive, I suppose it's disruptive is probably the word, this stuff can be. But yeah, so with the image generation though, even now, because I've been playing around with Mid Journey as well, and seeing what the sort of stuff that does, so it's quite fun. It's really, really fascinating to kind of try and get you to make something that you've got in your mind and put it out there in the world. And at the moment, it's got to the point, it can now, instead of making weird blobs of stuff that looks nothing like what you want, it can now make something that looks exactly like something, but it's almost never what you asked it to make. So it's incredibly good at making like a cat, like dual wielding knives or something like that, but it's never the cat you want. There's always like, you've got to try and iterate on it, and it's been aging, and he's trying to get it to change its pose. And like, if I tell it to leap, will leap make it work? No, it's just like, no leap. It sort of like ends up in this weird kind of stance. And then you're like, no. Was, you know, how do I get the color of that hat to change? Like, no, why is the background sky now purple? You know, the experience has really been that kind of feeling of trying to make it do something. And what it turns out is incredible. If you just had someone walk in the room at that point, not knowing what you'd asked for, and it goes on, you go, wow, that's incredible. That's a world-class piece of art. But getting it to make what you want, that's the key. And I suppose that's where the question is, can it get to the point where it really crossed the divide between the intention of the user and the outworking of that image?
If that would happen, would you guys consider using AI image generators at all?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, really nuanced question. I mean, the first thing, I've been talking to our team about this and trying to get their impression on it. I was talking to Don John and Jessica about it and all this sort of thing. And there's obviously from that side a very clear, there is a problem in the way that things are working right now, primarily because of the way that something like Midjourney and things like that, they're often scraping data from something like ArtStation, which is where a lot of these professional artists put up their work to try and generate more work for themselves. And so instead, what's happening is these AIs are able to scrape that data and then use that as the bed foundation of images. And so it's Greg Grotkowski, isn't it? He's been famously one of these kind of the key art words used in AI image generations. He was doing a podcast. So it was interesting because he was saying that he's got more work than he's ever had before. I'm wondering if that's because whenever he's become famous as being as keyword, obviously everyone wants the real thing. And so they've actually gone to him. So there's a weird side of that. We're actually becoming AI famous as an artist. May actually mean you get more real world work out. I don't know. But certainly the problem here seems to be there's a massive lack of regulation over the whole system at the moment. It's moving too quick, way too quick. And people don't, and there's not been any, I think the regulation stuff tends to be 5 years behind a lot of this stuff, and it needs to catch up. And so right now, I think it's incredibly dangerous for any company to start using what's available at the moment, because you don't know where the lawsuits and things, there's already class action lawsuits around this stuff that have been prepped and ready. They're starting to move through the system. And so what happens in a couple of years' time when maybe it does go that way and it comes down the side of the artists, and then people say, anything that was used from a data set scraped from ArtStation is no longer commercially viable, and you can get sued if you ever use it. And then you've got all this artwork that you've been spending all this time trying to generate and prompt and do all this stuff, and actually none of it is commercially viable, even though Midjourney may say it's commercially usable. And that's really the question. It feels very confusing, I think, when you join up with something like Midjourney. When you join up with Midjourney, you have these tiers, and you've got a basic tier that just means you can just make some images of that. But then you have a commercial tier that you can buy in at, which is a bit more expensive. And they say you can use all of those images commercially in products. And I don't know how true that is, in terms of the long term, whether or not that would actually be rescinded at some point and what would happen in that. Because it's just a whole new world. We've never had robots making something like this and then having to decide who owns the product, when it's taking from this stuff. I think it's quite dangerous for any company to be getting involved in it at the moment, because there's just too much unknown about where to go. So there's that side. There's clearly the fact that there's a regulation needed which allows the artists to decide whether or not their data is usable within this thing, because it is, although it's creating something new, it is actually primarily only able to make that from the artist. It's definitely clear that the artwork that you generated when you use a prompt name like Greg Rutkowski, that image is only possible to be made through the AI because it has absorbed this guy's artwork
from a database,
spirit of it, and then can churn out something similar to it. And so that feels clearly that guy should be remunerated for that if he and have the option to not have that included in the database because it is copyright. What happens, do we get to a point where, from a regulation perspective, artists could sell their artwork to the databases if they wanted to? I did actually ask my team if any of them would be happy to do that. Would you be happy to ever sell your art? And they would all say this was super short-sighted. You can't think of many artists that would want to sell their art to the things. Just kind of actively replacing yourself, short-term gain for long-term loss, with that type of activity. My response to them was, I wonder what happens then if you get these mid-level artists that maybe are struggling, and what if these AI generating companies, if they start employing artists to start making art and say, look, you've got some stable, if it can be a bit famine or feast, I think, with the art world, right? It can be that you end up, so it may be that, to get a stable income, someone would just become an in-house artist, start making some of this stuff and start building up that database. And in that way, nobody could claim that it's being taken from somebody unfairly, or taken from the ArtStation world in a way that wasn't remunerated. And so if that happens, then you get into a different question. It's no longer about, is this machine stealing someone else's stuff? It's the question is it okay that we live in a world where this machine is able to replace a lot of the kind of the artwork at a quality level that's instantaneous and very quick and very cheap? Like, is that, because I think one way or another, we're getting there. I don't think there's any stopping that at this point. I think we're going to get to a point where every company has to decide, are you okay generating what you want out of AI, or should you go through the more creative route of, you know, if you are actually using artists? That's going to be coming. It's just a matter of time, and everyone's going to have to decide that. AI will eventually be able to create much of what you need from an art perspective. And it will be regulated in a way that this is the, you could say this artwork was generated by somebody who was getting paid properly for it. That's the question. Even if a bunch of other artists would say, maybe agree that this is a short-sighted for the artists who are doing this to take it. Because in any group of people, you only need a few of those artists to agree to it. You know, how many people would agree to a, you know, 100 grand a year salary working in-house at an AI art generating company that could just start? You know, it's very difficult to say no to that, especially if you've run into difficulties yourself. And of course, this system really puts pressure on the art community in general, right? There'd be more and more pressure on the art community to take a sure thing over. So, you know, it's very difficult to see how that would last. And I suppose this is a bit like the comparisons, like the Industrial Revolution, right? What happened there with like the seamstresses, you know, it's all cottage industries. It was all these individual, like high quality, creative seamstresses. And then the factories start opening, making dresses, and they're just super quick. Just they start churning this stuff out. And in one generation, the entire lot is kind of like replaced, you know, and it's these, you know, these people are cast into poverty, and this terrible kind of situation where, like, I think it was one of the sharpest drops in life expectancy in human history happened around the Industrial Revolution, where they just dropped, where they came from the cottage rural industry of rural areas and went into the industrial kind of warehouses and the slog and the terrible wages and the lack of labor laws and everything like that. And so you can see how that could very easily come as a reaction to this thing from that side of the art community, right? The idea that they could just be replaced very, very quickly. And that you obviously, in reaction to that during the Industrial Revolution, you had the Luddite Revolution, right? So you have the Luddites tried to stand against this technology and said, this isn't fair. This is destroying craftsmen's, you know, like jobs. This is like, yeah, the, we need to protect these skilled laborers, you know? And in the end, that just failed. You know, it couldn't stand up against the weight of progress and time, and just the fact there were just too many people who were just like, I will not pay 3 or 4 times as much for that, you know, that dress or that thing, whatever I'm buying, you know, compared to, I'd rather take it cheaper. And that seems to have been the journey of history. And so I don't know if, regardless of whether or not there is a moral stance that people would say this is definitely where things should be, I don't know if there's any stopping it now that it's out of the, you know, Pandora's box has been opened.
In your dystopian vision, instead of the struggling artist in Paris living off of one jar of peanut butter, crying over her artwork in her studio, she's going to have massive sweatshops with artists that are not good enough to be working on Oathsworn, but they are good enough to work for the AI companies, just churning out artwork just to feed the AI. And no one actually ever sees their original work, just feeding the algorithm.
That may not even need to last that long. That's the terrible thing, so that you only need them to do, you know, they may only need a few million images, you know, and then the AI can take it from there, you know, and iterate on it even further. You know, it's even worse than the Industrial Revolution in that way, because this AI is capable of taking that and very cheaply innovating and iterating on those ideas to the nth degree. And I really don't know if there's an upside that will be able to be drawn from the art community from this. But then there is something I can say at the moment. It's the one thing that you can't get into. That's that idea that AI images right now cannot get you to where you want it to be, right? You can't. If I wanted to make, no matter how many times I've tried it, I can't make something that's in my mind come into an image. It's often just a slightly different thing. It's okay if you want something very generic. If you want like a mountain with a lake, because there's no right answer to what a mountain with a lake looks like, right? There's just a million different ways you could make that and be justifiably a mountain with a lake. But if there's something specific you want, like a particular people in a sci-fi world who have armor that has a particular thing and weapons that do a certain thing, and they're in a scene, which is this grand epic of like two warring factions in space, you know, with all these asteroids coming and the spaceships here and this thing here. And there's two main characters that are in the middle of the scene that are the focal point. And one of them's got this amazing, like, you know, thing. These other guys are like, you know, if you want it to be like very specific like that, I don't think you can get there now and get it to make that thing. And I don't know if it's going to be possible in the future. So there's, at that level, it may be that there may be a stopper on AI that just means you can't get the clean compositions and the content specific enough to make it commercially viable for the majority of big creative projects like sci-fi and fantasy, and, you know, which is obviously a lot of board games are based around. However, if you want to do something like natural, if you want to do something like birds, and you want to make a game about birds and just have them be in a particular art style, you could definitely do that right now, and it just work immediately. So there's always going to be that. I think there's going to be a base for artists, at least for a long time with that stuff. The AI is very good at replicating with iteration, but not necessarily good at taking that next leap in creativity that makes you go, wow, I've never seen that before. That's awesome. A sword that is made of light. That's all, you know, like that's, you know, wow, what a cool idea, you know. And that's it, you know, you that one idea and suddenly you've sold a billion toys, right? Right. But so there's something there that I think an artist will always be able to bring in a much purer way than the AI will be able to do. And it might be that what that does is, instead of, because there are different groups of artists, to be honest, I'm, you know, being fair, not all artists are creatively minded. They have a skill, and some artists are good at executing that skill on a given task. So they're good at perhaps the rendering of a thing, and they understand the technical needs of composition and doing things like that. But in terms of creative, like we really have found that is a very difficult part of the process, is creating the look of a new monster, creating the look of new weapons and new artists, new people groups and that sort of thing, creating a new city that just looks like no city anyone's ever seen before. Like, that is a very specific subset of artists. And I don't think that the AI can replace them. And I also think that group of people is going to become more and more valuable in this world, and that the artists who are more skilled but less creative in their designing abilities is going to be where that the AI starts to really heavily put pressure on them. Because if it's just the fact that you have this simple thing that the world already knows exists and you want to make it manifest in a picture, then that thing the AI will be able to do, especially anything that's not sci-fi or fantasy, or, you know, anything too fictional, basically anything that's grounded in something that already exists is going to be very easy to replicate.
Wow. I think this is the most balanced answer I've ever heard to this discussion, because most folks are either like, absolutely not, or absolutely yes. And I think you've actually laid out a very well thought out path for how it might play out, where there's just like a different role for certain artists and just how everyone will adapt to it. But you are of the opinion, right, that this is unstoppable and it's not going anywhere.
If you look back to history, I don't think there's an example of this sort of thing being in the box once it's been opened like this. It's sad, because the reality is that the progression always comes with this thing. It's just part of the process of what we call progress. But then, you know, it's become debatable about whether or not that's actually true when, you know, you've got a lot of real people really hurting.
Here we have on the show a man who has raised over $5 million on Kickstarter. So why don't we use the last 10 minutes to tease out a little bit how you did that?
I think the success of Swan is that there's a hole in the market. There's a place that you have to fight. If you can see a hole, that's where you're really where it started. For us, we saw that there was a hole in these kind of grand thematic stories. I mean, there is a very common kind of parlance in board gaming when I was starting Oathsworn that was like, there are just no good story games in board gaming. There are no good story games. And I was like, huh, no good story games, you say? Well, you know, they'll give me 5 years to see what we can do about that. You know, it's that idea of there being holes that you can fill with ideas. And so it just, you know, it can take an idea, takes a bit of risk, takes some cash, takes some hard work, and then you might be able to get there. So, I mean, board gaming is a bit of a weird spot. So if the audience is not board game related, board gaming is like, it's this huge kind of niche that it's nowhere near as risky as you want to create a new type of stamp or something. You know, where board gaming is like a nearly $10 billion a year industry at this point. And so it's a massive deal. So if you, as long as you know that industry very well. And actually a real key thing I think that seems to be true of creating something new is go to the next stop along the way. Don't just go to the end of the journey with like something new, like go to the next step, iterate on what has come before, know what's come before, know where the next steps are. Because if you get to, there's a weird thing that people love iteration, but not innovation, I suppose is the other. You can actually be too innovative with a concept, and it's just people may not be ready for it yet. And so you see this with people throughout history, is that they were just too innovative for their time and the world wasn't ready for their technology yet. So just being aware of that, like not going too far ahead of where people are right now, because there's a safety in that and people can see the value of it much more easily. Going very, very far into the future with innovation, people cannot see the value of that innovation yet, because you have to convince them it's maybe too deep a concept or too hard to get people to acknowledge that and appreciate that. Or are you just being, are you being iterative? And if you're being iterative, it's a pretty good place to be compared to like hyper innovative, which I mean, sometimes it might work, but I think generally that seems to hold up from what I've seen.
How did you know how to build a campaign, how to do pre-launch, all that stuff? And what did you do to get to these huge numbers?
Yeah, so I mean, the building hype is a big part of any Kickstarter. The hype's really started a solid year before the Kickstarter even went off. So you're talking about getting the influencers of that product. Influencers are absolutely vital in today's world, like knowing the influencers in your market and being able to reach them with early prototypes and things like that, and being able to talk about what's coming, being in the zeitgeist and the conversations that are happening. Obviously, with that, is the convention scene as well is a big part of the board game world, because there's always a lot of influence in that convention scenes that you get to talk to about, and you get to meet a few thousand people, and that really helps build that up. I think we had like 2,000 people signed up through conventions we went to. We went to Kickstarter with roughly 5,000 people because we built a website, and we had the website as a sign up, which was key. Like the newsletter, we had a newsletter we published stuff through as well, leading up to it to get people excited and kind of let them know what was coming and how what to. As I said, we had roughly 5,000 at that point. We were very confident having 5,000 people signed up felt healthy, that we were going to be able to reach the point of being able to make a couple of thousand games, and on top of them, obviously getting on the Kickstarter platform.
Yeah. How do you break through with an influencer, for example? Like, how do you get them to choose your game to review instead of one of the other 8,000 that comes out?
Professionalism is the first thing. It's a shame that if you don't have money to make a professional looking product at the start, Kickstarter is not something where you can come with a dream where you have no money and then make something that then will raise money to let your dream become reality. That concept died like in 2013. Right? Like it's a long time ago that you could actually come with an idea. And so Kickstarter has now moved into a much more professional state where you have to come with an almost finished product to people and then say, can you help us get enough of the manufacturing of this finished product? And so that's what you've got to kind of like settle that with yourself. That if you want to get into making, say, a board game, you need to have that after like professionally created full product and the ability to advertise that. For most influencers, that's just the level. They need you to take it seriously to get to that point. And then those doors open, I think, to them. And genuinely, though, they are really up for almost anything that's professional at that level. You've got a prototype that is professionally done. Almost everyone will play that and look at it. Sometimes they want to see it at a convention. You do a 15-minute pitch to them or something like that at a convention before they commit to doing it more, because they don't want to spend like 6 hours learning and playing your game for the first time.
If you have one big tip or something that you wish you knew then, you know now, about running a big Kickstarter campaign or getting it to be big, what would it be?
It's difficult. I've had a journey in learning to let go of some of the crazy levels of control. If I look back and looked at all the stuff that's happened for Osworn, I consider us more of a blessed company than an efficient one. But so much of what happened was stuff happening just at the right time, meeting the right people, having good people you can trust, and just having people around that you can meet that you trust. Like, I think it's a really wonderful time. You're looking at yourself and thinking, have I got a product I can start making? Can I start building a company of that? If you've got one or two good people around you, you can say, yeah, you know what? I trust this person. We're going to go on a journey together. You will have so much more power to bring something into the world with somebody you can trust than if you feel there's a fracture and a disconnect with somebody and there's like a real problem there. But you know, that is wonderful to see that really at the heart of most products is basically a bunch of relationships with people you can trust to get something done. And it's really encouraging. And so I think that trusting in the people in your team and asking the question, can you trust? And do you feel like you're going to be able to do that together? And not underestimating how valuable that is to find someone you can do that. Because most of the majority of games and companies I've seen fall down have fallen down primarily just for the fact that at some level people distrusted each other and they couldn't trust someone to work and turn up for stuff and do things and competency. So like, if you can find those people, they're like gold, you know, they're up, and you can do a lot more than you think with that group of people. And then you're trusting the ride.
Before we go the surface, what did you do? Did you have a circus?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a mobile circus that we used to do. It started out being called the Friendship Society Circus. It turned into the Ministry of Joy, and you get like 300 or 400 kids come in, and you just let them go crazy, and you have this chance to do a bit of fundraising, introduce them to a lot of the social welfare programs and stuff like that, a lot of the youth groups and kids groups, and you know, other things that are framed. You turn up in kind of nice sort of like place between the unengaged kind of people who were in need of the things and the charities that are in areas. So that's what we did for a number of years. We went around with this kind of mobile circus, had a big top hat, and we went around kind of doing pop-up circus things and silly games and that kind of thing.
Is it similar in the feeling to promoting your Kickstarter, sort of going around town in a big top hat and promoting your thing?
Yeah, it's funny. There's not a lot of difference for you. And it's not rocket science. You know, promoting is very simple. You know, it's that idea of just getting in front of the eyes of the people who are your market, the audience that you want to get, and then just, you know, picking whichever rich you can get to meet those people. make a good unique selling point, make it a good price, make sure that it's quality and that you care about them, and that's it. You know, put customer service and you're good to go.
Amazing. Jamie, thank you so much for your time. Incredibly inspiring. I feel like we could and should do this again and go way deeper on some of the topics because there's so much to talk about, but this was absolutely insightful. So thank you again for your time. If people want to follow along, or can they late pledge anywhere, where can people buy into Oathsworn right now?
You should either go to GameFound or go to our Kickstarter page. If you type in Oathsworn, it will very quickly pop up with the Kickstarter page. Go to the second Kickstarter and you click the link on late pledge, and it will take you through to be able to late pledge the game. You get that, and we've got a few more months where the late pledge will be open. So if you did want to come and join us, you're very welcome to, and that'll get you the game alongside all the other Kickstarter backers who backed it. So you're in good company. There's 20,000 good men and women who've got the game already.
Thank you for listening to the Crowdfunding Academy podcast. To get in touch with me or join the Creator Discord, please follow the links in the show notes.